9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We have liftoff.
Ladies and gentlemen, the person we're about to talk with is someone you know already, love dearly. He is Mr. Underdog. He's the grandson of legend and SJU Hall of Fame coach, Jim Boyle. As a junior, he averaged the most points for any Hawk player since Jameer Nelson in the 2003-2004 season. At just 24 years old, this person became the assistant coach for the University of Albany. If you don't know who I'm talking about now at this point, you should probably turn off the pod because this one's not for you. Coach Ryan got the dog in him daily. How are we doing, man?
I'm doing all right, man. Just, you know, preparing for this, you know, game Thursday. And then, you know, after we play, we'll have a road trip. We'll go down to Florida for a few nights and have a few games down there. So just, you know, getting ready for that.
Sure. Yeah. You guys have, I heard you picked up a game recently against Siena. That was unanticipated.
So we played Siena. You know, that's up here. That's a gigantic rivalry. It's like Duke Carolina up here. We had about 9,000 people at the game. We played at MVP Arena. It was great for our program. You know, great for the city, the community. It's been 4 or 5 years since the last time they called the Albany Cup. I was learning everything as fast as I could since I've been up here for, you know, 4 or 5 months. But, you know, the two schools hadn't played in 4 or 5 years. We were able to, you know, agree to a 3-year series. This was, you know, the first battle. And then the next 2 years after, we'll have a game each season. So, you know, it's a great thing for the community, great thing for our program, great thing for their program as well.
That sounds electric. I mean, I hope any game at St. Joe's has, you know, I love seeing the fans get riled up. So something like that.
They were fired up. That's awesome.
9,000 people. That's a good game. Yeah, I've been following along pretty closely on Twitter and other podcasts, sort of like curious as to what you've been up to. But why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about your journey? Like I said, you became an assistant coach at 24, which is pretty unheard of. Do you want to share a little bit about like what's that's been like and how you've gotten there?
Yeah, so I would say in March of, you know, March 22, so obviously what, eight months ago around that, you know, I'd been waived from the Clippers G League team, and I was kind of at a point in my life where I wasn't sure if I wanted to, you know, keep doing professional basketball, keep playing. You know, my heart's always been in basketball. I just wasn't sure if I wanted to keep playing and, you know, pursuing my dream at that. You know, so I made a decision in March. It was a little bit hard, a little difficult for me, but, you know, I talked to my parents. I talked to, you know, Phil a lot. Phil really helped me out just with clarity, among other things. You know, my little brother, Colin, you know, those are, you know, my parents, Phil and my brother are probably the four people that I go to for life decisions. And, you know, I knew my heart wasn't in it. And the way I'm built, like, if I'm not going to give 100%, then I'm not going to do it. And, you know, after I had been waived, I knew I didn't want to do it. So, you know, I immediately went to the Final Four. I had started, you know, letting people know I was interested in getting in the business. Now, did I see myself as an assistant right away? Or, you know, in my first year, I didn't. I just wanted an opportunity. And, you know, I had a few, you know, support staff roles, graduate assistant opportunities. You know, I took a job up at University of Albany with Coach Killings, who I've known since I was in seventh grade. I've had a relationship with him. Him and my dad are very close. You know, he's always felt like, you know, a family member to me. And you know, I made the decision in probably late May that I would, you know, accept the director of recruiting. And special assistant to the head coach. You know, so I immediately moved up in June, got started working camps, was working, you know, internal office stuff, as the summer kept going, one of our assistants, Coach Tibbs, while I was working, he was an assistant at the time at UAlbany. He was fortunate enough to, we're obviously we miss him, but he was fortunate enough to receive a job offer from Notre Dame. And that was something he couldn't turn away. So he ended up making that move. In the time that had happened, word had kind of gotten out that I was in the business and I was at Albany, and I got a chance to go on the road and recruit to fill in for an assistant who couldn't that weekend. So I met more people, people took it more serious. I interviewed for another D1 assistant job. I was offered that assistant job. And, at that moment, as I love Coach Killings and I had already kind of really fell in love with UAlbany and the players here. I just decided, let me just see this out, see what happens here. And, fortunately I was named an assistant, in early September, after Coach Tibbs had left. And since then I've been growing, learning a ton from Coach Killings, just how to treat people, how to run a business. I've learned so much in these last 4 or 5 months that, I truly can't put into words how it's been. And, I'm loving every second of it.
That is really, really interesting. So much to get into there. But it's great to hear about your relationship with both Dwayne Killings and Phil, seeing how much they've influenced your life as not only a player, but a person. But do you want to talk a little bit about, what it's like, been like sort of getting your feet wet in a program that isn't St. Joe's and sort of getting your own view on what it means to be a coach in college basketball?
Yeah. So obviously, I grew up, my grandpa was the head coach at St. Joe's from 19, I want to say 81 or maybe 83 to 92, I think it was. He was, and then my dad had played at St. Joe's. And then my dad, when I was growing up, he was a coach at Boston University. And then he was an assistant at Penn State. So, I saw that world, I knew the time commitment. I knew how much effort my dad had put in, but he loved it and it was rewarding for him. And I think that's kind of what I've found over the last few months, is that I'm in a extremely rewarding business, seeing improvements from guys who, truthfully, a lot of guys are trying to have, a similar career that I had in college, and I think I appreciate these players so much more than they could realize, because they're allowing me to help and grow them regardless of the similar, age difference. There's not a significant gap, but they're treating me like a coach and they're treating me like someone who's accomplished a lot in this coaching business, even though it's my first time being involved. And so I grew up in it. I knew I wanted to be involved with basketball. I knew I wanted to, and I always want to be around people I trusted. Coach Killings checks off all those boxes of just someone that I can, be around, who will help me. The part that I need to work on, every day it's a new, opportunity to grow. But, just how to work, I've never had a job before. Basketball players, I don't think people understand that, when you play basketball at the level that, I played at, you're not accustomed to being in an office. You're not accustomed to coworkers. You're not accustomed to waking up unless it's for practice. It's a regiment now. It's every day trying to learn more and more every day. And that's kind of where I'm at with it. And, a lot of people have helped me. My dad has taught me so much, my grandpa, even though he passed away, just the stories I hear about him, and, obviously Phil, Phil's been a big, big help for me. And, for that, I'm extremely appreciative.
That's so interesting to hear. And I mean, if anyone can do it, everyone listening knows, like, you're a tenaciously hard worker. So no doubt that you're
no,
going to,
I appreciate that, man.
But is there anything, you're really, this is a new venture for you, but is there anything that you know now as a coach that, looking back, you wish that you knew as a player so that you could go back and you could change?
That's a great question. I think for me specifically, the one thing I've learned is that there's always a bigger picture, right? Like, when you're a player, you're caught up in the games, you're caught up in practices, but everything that goes into a college basketball program, you know, from the president to the AD to the donors to the academic support staff to the strength and conditioning, you know, everyone has to be on the same page. And when you're in it, you don't realize how much of a collaborative effort is going on just to produce games and try to win games and everything that goes into a 31 game season. And that's what's made me open my eyes. I would say the most, just how hard, how much resources and how much time and effort people put into, you know, running a basketball program, which is, you know, like I said, it's a business.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of, you know, running a program and preparing and all of the work that you guys have been putting in, is there, I know you guys are definitely preparing for it, but is there anything on the top of your head that you're really thinking about ahead of the matchup against UAlbany and St. Joe's? I know you watch a lot of basketball, so I'm sure you have a lot to share. I don't know what you can share, but is there anything that you can share on the top of your head?
As far as preparing for this game?
Yeah.
I know Coach, how he operates as, you know, an offensive mind. I know what his philosophies are. Now he's creative and he's always trying to change it. So I think, you know, paying attention, you know, watching games. I mean, I can't tell you how many games I've watched from last year, the two exhibitions, I've watched all four of the times they've been in action. Right. And that's, you know, you're just trying to understand, you know, I know the players and the, you know, I have a decent understanding of what they do and what they don't do. But I'm just really, really, you know, excited for this game and every game. You know, it's hard to say that this game is the same as every game because of how much the school St. Joe's means to me. But I'm just trying to, you know, keep my composure and really, you know, keep learning, even though I'm preparing, just keep learning and, you know, don't miss anything that, you know, I'm taking for granted because of the familiarity. I'm just really trying to catch myself and view it from a bird's eye view, not someone who has seen it, been there, you know, done that. Cause, you know, sometimes you're blinded to things that you might miss because you take it for granted how close you are to the program, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely. I appreciate the insight that you can provide there. And I want to pick your brain about one of the games that I know you said you watched all four games. So I would like to pick your brain a little bit, even just about sort of the mindset that you have as a player and what you take away from games, specifically games against elite teams. So I know everyone knows you've played against really, really top of the line teams, whether it be like Villanova, Auburn, Kansas. Well, I don't know if you were in the Kansas game, but anyway.
Yeah, I played Kansas. Yeah.
You played a bunch of tough teams. What's it like, you know, during and after a game like St. Joe's just played against Houston, where you're playing against the top team? What's going on in your head during and after a game like that?
That's a great question. So, you know, obviously we played a challenging schedule when I was at St. Joe's, you know, Tennessee, Villanova twice, Auburn, Kansas, a lot of teams. You know, I think every program has an identity, right? So with Villanova, they're just going to be so solid that they're never going to mess up and they're never going to give you a chance, really. They're going to try to just slowly suffocate you just by keep doing what they're doing. Kansas, you're dealing with Christian Brown, Ochai, you're dealing with NBA physical athletes who are skilled. With Houston, their identity is they're the toughest team in the country. They believe it. Most analysts believe it. Coaches, you know, they set the standard of what toughness is, defense, harassment, all that. They are the gold standard of that, you know, and every coach tries to emulate their physicality and their approach to the game. So for them, I knew St. Joe's going into that game, you know, they're fearless. Eric, Cam, Christian, they're fearless. You know, Coach Lang, they're fearless, as they should be. You know, they all are very good at what they do. You know, in that game, they're probably going into it and they're just trying to just keep throwing blows because Houston's going to keep punching. They're never going to stop. And you just want to keep, you know, stacking. And I know St. Joe's didn't get the result they may have wanted, but even though they lost the game, there's still plenty of lessons that they learned that they'll take with them when they get to the A-10, when they have Dayton or they have, you know, VCU, similar athletes and physicality. So You know, I think during those games, you're as a competitor, you're like, let's go. And then after you dwell on it, what you could have done better, what went wrong, what went right, and then you learn from it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. A team like Houston, like you said, the most, probably one of the most respected teams in the country. It felt like when we were playing them that they just sucked the air out of the room. Like they anticipated passes. They just ran. I don't know. Hard to play.
Yeah, Houston, you know, their program is the gold standard for physicality, defense, toughness. You know, they guard you when you walk in the place before the game even starts. That they're matched up on you. That's the way I look at it. You know, tremendous, tremendous amounts of respect for, you know, that program and how they play. You know, they had that run last year to the Elite Eight. They shot the ball poorly against Villanova. They were right there, you know, in an Elite Eight matchup because of how physical, how connected, how together that group is. And, you know, St. Joe's played them well. You know, they didn't get the result they wanted. But like I said, there's so many lessons I'm sure they learned and they're taking with them. And, you know, they're going to be, you know, trying to improve day in, day out for the lessons they were taught in that game.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to touch upon you just briefly mentioned Villanova right there, and I know we're sort of changing directions here, but if we could, looking back at your time at St. Joe's, if you want to talk about maybe what some of those your Philadelphia kid, your Delco kid, what did the games in the Big Five mean to you, especially the Villanova games? Like, as a fan, like, it means a lot to me, but as a player who has so much history with, you know, St. Joe's and, you know, your father and your grandfather and you're a coach's son, like, what do the Big Five games mean to you?
The Big Five to me is the most special league, even though it's an unofficial league, you know, in the world. I don't think there's a city that cares about college basketball. You know, North Carolina, the state cares about Duke and North Carolina and, you know, NC State. But I think a city, you know, you have, and I'll count Drexel, you have six Division I schools in a 10 to 15 mile radius with fans that are diehard obsessed with the program. And, you know, it's special. You know, I grew up the Plesher doubleheaders, the Streamers, you know, I remember vividly St. Joe's when, you know, Phil was there. Just, I remember a dunk CJ Hagan threw down. I was in the building and I remember just the feeling of Hagan, you know, shake, or the field house at that point, just shaking, almost, you know, collapsing. You know, those are the moments when you're a kid, you don't even realize that, you know, you're building what you want for your life. You're planning your life, even though you don't realize it because it's natural and it's normal to you. And, you know, people outside of the city don't understand it, but when you're in the city and you grow up in it, the passion, the dedication, the camaraderie of the Big Five with every school knowing how much it means to them. You know, just, I was so fortunate to be born in, you know, where I was born and, you know, born into the family of basketball lineage that I was. So I could really experience and, you know, treasure, because that's what, you know, they're memories that I'll treasure for the rest of my life.
Wow. Those are some beautiful insights. So when you play a school like Villanova, that's been so dominant, Does the result ever sort of get you down as a player? Because, I mean, for us as fans, we're always thinking, like, you know, St. Joe's could beat this team. What is it like for you as a player? Like, do you guys also have a similar mindset, or is it a little bit more like, what's the mindset from a player standpoint, having been in Coach Lang's locker room? Like, what's it like, even in you were in Martelli's locker room too, but not able to play? Like, what are those locker room situations like and preparations like?
Man, anyone who's, you know, a competitor goes into every game thinking that they're going to win, right? Even if, you know, when I was at St. Joe's and we played the Eastern Conference All-Stars, I'm thinking we're going to win. And that's genuine. That's not fake. That's just the belief I had in the people around me, myself, you know. So, yeah, and those locker rooms, you know, it's interesting. You know, most people think everyone's amped up, but, you know, they're amped up internally because you don't want to become too emotional and too jittery, and it causes you not to play the way you want to. So those locker rooms, you know, everyone's got their headphones in. You know, the team meals, they're quiet. They're just – everyone's locked in on one mission and one goal. And, you know, Coach Martelli and Coach Lang, you know, the programs, everyone we went into, you know, every game we went into, we were thinking we were going to win. That's just, you know, as a competitor, when you're at this point you know, when you get up here, you know, to that level, you just go in with the mindset that, listen, like, they got some stuff with them, we got some stuff with us. Like, we're going to duke it out and see who comes up on top.
Any game that I watched with Ryan Daly, and I always knew that we could win that game. And
thank you. I appreciate that.
I have this one story about you being a competitor that I really want to hear more about. So this is a story going a while back. I think it was 2021, a game you hadn't played, and you come back. You didn't know you were going to play the next day. You tore some ligaments in your thumb. Would you care to share how you knew that you were ready to come back? I don't want to steal your thunder.
Oh, no, I'll be honest. I have nothing to hide. I had no idea. So I had a setback in mid-January on my thumb. I got my cast off after – I had my cast taken off after 4 weeks, and I was told that it wasn't healing the way it should have. I was right on the verge of not surgery or surgery. I elected no surgery because that would have knocked me out the whole year, so I wanted to – you know, I was a tough kid. And so I had the setback. I was emotional. Coach Lang, you know, he helped me a lot, you know, just told me get healthy, you know, we'll figure it out. You know, he was worried about long-term. I only cared about St. Joe's. I didn't care about my health going forward after St. Joe's, cause that's how much the school meant to me. And then I would say probably a day before or 2 days before the game, I called my mom and I was like, I'm going to ask to get this cast taken off, because if I'm going to ever play again, it's going to be now. I'm not interested in, you know, 2 weeks after the A-10 tournament, I get my cast off and I'm ready for pre-draft or, you know, workouts or 3-on-3 tournament, the All-Star games or whatever. So I'm going to try it. You know, my mom is like, Ryan, you know, be careful, you know, because I've rushed myself from injuries and I've gotten re-injured in my life. You know, that's just the type of kid I am. I'm sometimes foolish and naive about, I'm not a doctor. Let's just say that. And I took it off. I played. I ran steps every day to stay in shape. You know, head coach or the strength coach, Eric, did an unbelievable job with that. And then, you know, I took it off. I went to practice. Then they asked me to play 3-on-3 after to see how it went. And it went all right. And I was like, all right, I'm good to go. And I called my mom and dad. And this is, you know, 24 hours before the game. I said, I think I'm going to go. Or what do you think if I play? And they said, well, you're not asking us. You're telling us. And I was like, yeah, I'm telling you guys I'm playing. And they were like, all right, here we go again. And then that was that. And, you know, I stayed ready with the help of Eric Lang, the strength coach, who I think truthfully is the best at what he does in the country. He's the best I've ever seen. Even when I went professional, I think that, you know, he's so high level that he, you know, he kept me ready. He kept me engaged. He made it fun when I was trying to get back. And then, you know, we came back and, you know, my thumb was bothering me. I had tape. I didn't really have much mobility in it, but I knew, you know, with Taylor and Jordan and Cam that, you know, we could go on a little bit of a run when I came back if you know, we hit on all cylinders. And, you know, that 4-game stretch was so fun. You know, that was my lasting memory of St. Joe's. You know, what better to go out with a 4-game win streak and winning at Richmond, you know, beating Dayton at home by a lot, you know, beating LaSalle twice, just lifelong memories that I'll always have. And, you know, if I never got my cast off, if I never took that risk, then, you know, I wouldn't have it.
Wow. That O-time thriller and those 4-game win streak also is just one of the bright spots of the last five, 6 years of St. Joe's basketball. So good thing you took the cast off and you tried punching your thumb. I mean, we're all lucky because that happened.
I appreciate it.
You know, looking back, I had another question I wanted to ask you, sort of thinking about, you know, you weren't necessarily coming into college. People didn't know.
You don't need to sugarcoat it. I wasn't recruited or thought of. So you don't need to sugarcoat it.
Exactly. But they, by all means, people seem to be pretty. I mean, they couldn't have got it more wrong. How does that sort of inform the way that you approach recruiting? I mean, you were the head of recruiting, or I don't know what your official title was, at Albany just this summer. How's that inform the type of players that you look at? When you're approaching sort of the recruiting life as a coach?
That's a great question. Like I said, everyone has bias from their experiences. You know, I remember vividly my senior year of high school. and just after the season, you know, you win Catholic League MVP, you usually get 10 to 15 offers. I had nothing. And I grinded, man. I worked and I kept believing in myself, regardless of what, you know, all the local coaches said, all the, you know, the lower level D1s said. You know, I had two schools pull their offers from me. I went through a lot. So I always value mental toughness. Like, you know, if a kid's missing shots, is he going to, you know, do the other things that it takes to win? Because, you know, that's what I was, you know, before I became, you know, kind of a scorer in college, I was the gritty guy, the undersized four man who would rebound and try to just, you know, impose my will in that way, because I wasn't an elite shooter and I didn't really have an opportunity to score. And, you know, I don't know if I was ready for that. So I always side with kids that are competitive, because if you're competitive, you can do what you want, or you can have success. If you refuse to let someone impose their will on you because you're going to never back down, I think that goes a long way with me. And that's the program we're trying to build here. We have a lot of guys who felt overlooked at times, or they felt like they didn't get the attention they needed or deserved. And, you know, they battle. And, you know, anyone who battles, regardless of talent, size, height, weight, anything, if you battle, you know, you can play with or for me any day. And that's kind of the mindset I have here. And, you know, Coach Kinley's vision is aligned with that. You know, we want competitors. We want people who will leave everything out there on the line, because that's all we know as well.
Wow. Yeah. I'm sure as a player that's like probably music to any player's ear.
I hope so.
From that perspective, you know, the recruiting world is changing a lot. And, you know, you want the type of guys who are, you know, who hustle and who play hard and who, you know, really want it. But recruiting's changed. Like, the way that you were introduced to college basketball is way different than the world that we're in right now.
Dramatically.
You had to sit for an entire year after transferring. How? Yeah. Like, that's insane to think about now.
It's insane to think about. If I didn't, what, you know, it's insane. Yeah, it's all insane. It's insane. You know, I always told people, and I still tell people, that, you know, if I was a high school senior in this day and age, I wouldn't have received a Division I scholarship from Delaware. Because why would they take a fringe guy who they weren't sure about if they could take a guy who produced at a college level, even somewhat, right? Even if it's 4 or 5 points a game, you're probably taking him, you know. Now, I'm not saying that's my philosophy, but that's other philosophies that, you know, if you see production from someone that can play right away now with the no red shirt rule, you're probably going to take him. So, you know, in some sense, I got lucky at the time that I graduated. And then when I transferred, that was, I think, the last year that red shirts were a thing. I think the portal came in maybe a year after. Yeah, a year after. So it's different, man. You know, you used to, the teams with new coaches, they used to do, when my dad was in the business at Penn State, you know, a new coach would get the job and they would, you know, if they were trying to win right away, they were going to the grad transfer market because they could play right away. But everyone else had to sit a year, or they would take the transfers, load up 3 or 4 of them, and then take their lumps the first year. And then that second year you have grown men playing a year older, a year in college with your strength coach, your nutritionist, all that. Nowadays, it's, you know, it's almost a free for all. You know, people go here and there every other day. You know, people are popping up in the portal right now after 3 or 4 games. So it's a totally new world. You know, you got to adjust, you got to adapt, or you get left behind. And, you know, that's what I'm trying to do. That's what our staff's trying to do. That's what every staff in the country is trying to do. Just stay ahead of the curve, because you don't want to get caught behind the curve, you know?
Absolutely. Sort of thinking about, you know, staying new and sort of also staying a little bit old school. Is there any story looking back, as your time going back again to your time as a player, thinking about like a really like funny story traveling with the team that, you know, you carry with you to this day, and you're like, oh wow, like I want my players to experience something like that, on my team.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. When I transferred to St. Joe's, you know, red shirts weren't allowed to travel unless it was over winter break and you had a certain GPA. You know, I met the GPA requirements and I was able to travel to Duquesne. Unfortunately, that's when Checo got injured. But, you know, the night before, just the camaraderie that team had, you know, even though we struggled on the court, you know, that year I redshirted, Jared Bynum, who I forged a lifelong relationship with, Fresh Kimball. You know, we stayed up all night. We were playing cards. You know, the games matter, but it's the friendships you make. And, you know, for our program, that's what we're about. We're about, you know, a family, you know, creating memories that'll last 40 years down the line. You know, we want people that in this program that care and like each other so much that they're at each other's weddings and reunion. And, you know, that was eye opening because, you know, I hadn't felt that at Delaware, even though I liked all my teammates. It wasn't the bond that, you know, that St. Joe's team had. And we were all trying to figure it out, but we were all trying to figure it out together. Right. And, you know, I still remember that trip because it was the only trip I was allowed on. And, you know, with Coach Phil, you know, that was special, man. That was a really, really fun time on the road. And then obviously, you know, over the next few years, you know, a lot of people left, with the coaching change and, you know, me, Anthony and Taylor and Lorenzo stayed. And then, you know, Ramir Moore came, Cam Brown came, you know, Cam Brown, I can't say enough about that kid as a human being and as a player. You know, I loved every second I spent with him. He immediately became like a close friend to me. And, you know, just stuff like that you'll always bring with you, regardless of when the ball stopped bouncing for anyone.
Hearing about those stories, like I just think about how important it is, like friendships and bonds are on teams and
trust. It all comes back to trust.
Trust.
You know, you build memories with people, you know how their heart beats, you know, you trust them and you know that stuff carries onto the court, you know, trust from the coaching staff down to the players, you know, all that stuff translates, you know, off the court translates on the court more than a lot of people realize. Can't play with people you don't like, can't be around people you don't like. You need to be in good situations, whether that's in basketball or the real world, you know, you just got friend groups, whatever, you know, that's kind of what I realized through the game of basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have my co-host hopping on right now, Anthony Morelli. I have to go because I have night class at 7. I'm going to make him the host. But Ryan, like, this was incredible to be able to sit down and talk with you, man. Thank you so much. I can tell you.
Thank you for your support, guys. I really appreciate it. You know?
You're going to be an amazing coach.
I hope so.
You already are. So thanks so much for just sitting down and talking with me.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
For those listening to this part of the podcast, you've realized that Pete is no longer here, and that's because I have taken over. Pete has a grad school class he has to go to. So I'm with Ryan Daly. This is Tony, of course. And we're going to wrap up this podcast last 10 minutes here with a little bit more X's and O's to the team. This is something that I've been writing about at A10 Talk for a while now. I feel like scheme and, you know, traditional sets and styles of play have kind of gone out the window in college basketball. Everyone wants to be a little bit like the NBA. And Ryan, I'm sure you can disagree with me if you want, but that's kind of how I see it as of now. So I guess my first question for you is, when it comes to implementing a scheme, so say I want to run a modified Princeton, say I want to implement that, I want to recruit for that kind of style of player. One, how hard do you think it is to actually do that in the modern college landscape? And two, as a player yourself, how much do you look out for teams and how they scheme and how they play? You know, how do you factor that into your, or when you were at St. Joe's at minimum, how you factor that into your style of play as well?
Great question. So I think the first part of your question, I would say, you know, like you said, everyone's getting modernized. You have 6'11" kids shooting 3-pointers, 7 of them a game. You know, it's a different game. There's not as many back to the basket guys. I think the NBA has introduced to people the value of spacing and just, you know, just human genetics. Like if I can, you know, if I'm farther away from the guy with the ball, if he makes a move and drives, well, the defender guarding me has to help. And then it's a longer sprint back to the guy who he kicks it to, right? Like it's just, that's what the NBA has introduced. They've introduced faster pace. They've introduced, you know, really emphasizing corner positions for the wings so that the guards have dribble drive angles. You know, so yeah, the NBA has definitely, you know, shifted people's perception of, you know, basketball. Now it's different in college because one, there's no 3 seconds in college. Two, the level of players obviously is dramatically different from NBA players.
Right.
And then as far as a player, you know, like I touched on it, you know, earlier with Peter, that every team or program has a philosophy, right? Like I talked about, you know, Nova, they wear you down, they guard, they're so fundamental. They don't stop in what they do. So you have to play a near perfect game to beat them because they're never going to change how they are. And then with Houston, like I had mentioned, Houston's they're known across the country as probably the most physical team in the country. Mm-hmm. Baylor always has good guards. Kansas has freakish athleticism. Everyone has an identity. And it's just about when you're a player or a coach, you know, you're always trying to, for the next game you play, adapt to the identity of the other team, if that makes any sense. Like if the team isn't great at shooting, okay, maybe we're figuring it out if we're going to, you know, shorter closeouts, or if the team can really shoot the ball, but they can't put the ball on the floor as well, we're closing them out, running them off the line because their strength is behind the 3-point line. And threes, even though they're only worth one more point than the two, they're daggers. They kill your morale, right? Just threes, just back, offensive rebound, tip outs, daggers. Like that's what we call them. We call them daggers. And, you know, every team has their own identity and their own philosophy. And as a player and a coach, you know, it's all about figuring out the opponent and what they do best and what they don't do well. And that's what makes competition so fun in this sport.
Yeah. Very interesting. And I'll give you an example of like when I watch St. Joe's basketball, you follow the team still? Do you watch any of the games or how current are you?
Well, yeah. I follow college basketball. I follow St. Joe's. Yeah. I definitely watch, you know, St. Okay. Joe's. I watch the Olympics and I watch as many games as I can.
So, you know, how, like, you know, who Educate is clearly, one of the things that I love about Educate is that we always get a good inbound pass to him. Right. So he'll be at like closer to the top of the key. They'll do an inbound pass. They'll try to set up like a nice give and go, right? Give him the ball, have the guard run by, shake the defender. And then I always feel like we don't make the right pass. And I think it's hard for Educate because centers aren't trained to pass like that anymore. But it's something that, like, for example, Richmond did really well. They'd have these forwards and centers who would stand at the top of the key, and their ability to have some court vision to find the open player is really astonishing to me. And I think that's something that, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's one of the things that I kind of miss about college basketball is that level of thinking and that level of scheme. I think that's what I'm kind of hinting at, and the fact that it's just those kind of plays when they run really well, you're just like, man, that was a genius play that it opens up the guard every time, or they leave the defender to take the shot and they're good enough. They have that skill set to either attack the rim from 8 feet out or to make that 8-foot jump shot. I guess in that regard, you know, how hard do you think it is to train up players to elevate their game in that sense? So you yourself were a player. I'll give you a little story. I used to be on the track team, and every day at track practice, you would be in the gym shooting and we'd be up getting our meetings, and I would look in and there you are by yourself before practice taking shots. And this was when you had the city year at St. Joe's. So I just remembered, like, man, this guy does not stop grinding. So for you, and my whole tangent and spiel about player improvement and getting to a player to a certain level, you know, how does that look, and how much effort did that take for you?
That's a great question. So I knew I was not blessed with typical Division I basketball athleticism. I had to be very smart, and I had to be a hard worker, because a lot of my, you know, I tell the guys this here, you know, a lot of my production and my ability came from thinking the game. Now, I think thinking the game is a little bit of a lost art now in terms of, you know, common sense. Like, I use this for example, Luka Doncic, right? He's not explosive compared to the rest of his NBA peers. He can't jump like them, but he knows that if he's driving one way and a defender is running beside him, Luka has all the control because he can stop. And I don't care if it's LeBron James or the freakiest athlete in the world. If you stop on a dime, people are going to run by you and you'll create the separation. Now it's on you to make the shot. And I think I learned that at Delaware when I was more of a primary ball handler. So I always learned about angles and, you know, how to maximize my ability. Now, from a player development standpoint, you know, Coach Lang, they develop those guys, man. They really develop players. People make leaps and bounds, you know, Jordan Hall, for an example. I watched him last night. We got done our game. I came home and I watched the fourth quarter. That he is now is not the player he was when I met him.
Right.
And, you know, that's a testament to Coach Lang and developmental program. And then another part that goes unnoticed is you have to want to develop. You have to actually care to one, be able to take criticism and be able to understand that you don't know it all as a player. You know that
people, and if you, and like I told Peter, it all comes back to trust, and you need to have trust both ways, player, coach, coach, player, to that what the coach is trying to say, you have to be willing and humble enough to take that and understand that it's coming from a positive light. And I think I think there's some guys, some instances across the country in the NBA, there's specific examples that people probably could think about, or college basketball, their home, their team, that they think that they don't develop, but there might be more to that of why they haven't developed, right? It's not always on the coaching staff. The player has to be maniacal about their craft, because if they're not, someone else will be, right? And they'll beat you, yep, and they'll have the advantage. But there also has to be a level of willingness to do it and to accept coaching and not view it as a negative. And our guys here are great with that. They accept coaching. They love, you know, learning more. You know, we all have a ton of experience in this realm, you know, on this side of it. If you're a Division I assistant or a head coach, or you're on a staff, you know, you have a lot of experience. That's what got you there. And just the willingness to learn and ability to say, okay, yeah, I see where you're coming from. Let me try that. You know, that's an unrecognized part that's very, very valuable, that just the ability to learn and want to learn.
Interesting. I think that's a good point. And I know we're running up on time here, so I think we can end it with that. But Ryan, I have one last question for you. It'll be a quick one. It's a little bit more lighthearted, because I think that's the perfect thing to end on from a basketball standpoint. But I always like to ask our guests an interesting random question. And today's random question is this: you know, it's November 15th. Is it too early to listen to Christmas music? And we need an honest take here.
Yes. Thanksgiving.
You're a Thanksgiving guy. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Until I'm on the couch watching football, not being able to move for the next 3 hours because of how much I ate, I will not partake in Christmas
music. I think that's a message we all can get behind this holiday season, this Thanksgiving. So please don't
Everyone eat as much as you can, hang out on the TV, spend some time with your family, just chill until November, whatever, 26th, I think it is, or 25th, and then you can put on B101 back home, or
there,
you know, T102, whatever you want to put on.
I love it. New Jersey 101.5 for those New Jerseyans over across the river. Ryan, it was an absolute pleasure. I know I picked up for Pete, but I really do appreciate you sticking an extra 15 minutes here to ask and talk about some X's and O's. And it was an absolute pleasure. And thanks again for coming on the show.
No problem. Appreciate you guys having me.
Of course.